Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to be continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. My guest is Dr. Jim Garrison, and we're going to talk about looking at the state of our world's ruthless efforts for hegemony. Everyone's seeking power. So how can we find wisdom in this massive chaos? Every country will justify its actions. Everyone, whether they're committing themselves to genocide in Yemen, not just allowing Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait and Qatar, but also selling in the planes, providing the boots on the ground, intelligence, reconnaissance, blockades. All the while, people starve to death. All the while, you have not heard a single peep out of our academic and supposedly our more liberal educational leaders. You would have thought that this would have been a major effort. They would have gained the interest and the rage of the students, outrage of the students, and had some strikes because we're seeing genocide. When we think about how many times we have had genocide against a people, and there are over 60 that I can count. I'll just give you a few. Look in the Congo. You know where your cell phone comes from, but you know where the minerals in it come from. Well, what if I told you that either the diamonds or blood diamonds or the cobalt, all the minerals that are needed so that your life can be more convenient, cause someone to suffer? Is that right? Do you have any moral responsibility for anything other than simply consuming? Right now, the answer is no. Nobody seems, not nobody, but most people don't seem to consider the consequences of their actions. If they're going to live in a house, they don't ask, gee whiz, if this is in Napa, in Northern California, and it's bone dry, and there is a history of fires up here, is there a infrastructure, like a giant alarm that would go off, that allow you some time to know that there's a fire? Do you have exits? Do you have automatic sprinkler systems that would cover at least 30 to 50 acres around your properties in these developments? Have you been told how to protect your home? The answer is no. Then do you personally have any responsibility for where you live? The circumstances, you're on the beach, you're down in South Beach, you're on Miami Beach, you're in Coral Gables, you're in beautiful areas with wonderful neighborhoods. Do you have any responsibility for saying, am I in the wrong place at the wrong time to live here? Where's the wisdom in our crisis? We have crisis. We have crisis in confidence in the media, its biases, including the liberal media. Remember, it was the liberal media that helped support Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton going into Libya. But none of those so-called media went to Libya and first told us what Libya was like before the invasion. Libya was the Paris of Africa. Now, if they came back and said at least 95% of the people in Libya support the Gaddafi movement. By the way, Gaddafi was no longer in power when this all happened. There were over 10,000 decentralized committees that ran the country based upon probably the most widespread form of democracy in the United States. More women in Libya who are Muslim had rights than any other Muslim country in the world. In fact, it was actually a law established by the Libyan people. You could not insult a woman. Now imagine every day women are insulted just by the fact that they're not given any freedom in many of the countries. But those are normally Sunni countries, and a lot of Wahhabism is promoted through the madrasas of the schools that have been going on for decades by Saudi Arabia, spending billions of dollars of its own money to put up schools, so there's only one form of religious belief, and it's a very intolerant one. But we don't talk about that. There's no wisdom in understanding it. It's not about Islam. It's about how people take a religion and pervert for their own needs. We have a perfect storm right now. We have the worst global warming in history. We have more hurricanes at a higher intensity. I know, because I got hit with it right in southern Florida, southwest Florida, 161 mile an hour winds, category 4, did a lot of damage. Now, fortunately, I'd prepared. Even preparing and being able to protect human life, animal life, and the structures, it still did a lot of damage. The question is, do you want to go through this a second time? I'm working 10 hours a day with a chainsaw, cutting debris that had collapsed, getting a bobcat and reestablishing trees, saving all but 2 trees out of 50 trees that fell, pulling them back, restaking them, rerooting them, fertilizing them, and they're growing again. But other people just cut up the trees at $2,500 per tree I've seen. Actually, a neighbor told me that's what the guy wanted, and that's what he was going to pay to have 2 trees removed from his property. So did we learn anything? Nothing. And how about down the poor people, the people of color, living on the southeast side of Houston near the refineries, where all their land is polluted from the chemical overflow, and they're at sea level. So it's not, will they flood again? Will they go through this horror again? They'll go through it many times, probably twice a year now. Any lessons learned? Where's the wisdom? Doesn't exist. Our children obese. We're feeding them to death. No wisdom. We're electing sociopaths and miscreants, the worst of human nature, to all political offices. No wisdom. We're allowing the liberal media to tell us we should have had regime change. No wisdom. And going back to Libya, Libya had the longest lifespan in Africa, the highest per capita income in Africa, the highest literacy rate, higher than the United States per person. Yeah, 85% literacy. And they had no crime. They had no terrorism. They shared the wealth. You were given a stipend when you were married and when you had a child, and you were given a home as a natural right. In fact, the last person to live in a tent and not go into a house or an apartment was Gaddafi and his father. His father died before he actually had an apartment. And I'm not praising Gaddafi. I'm merely saying I'm praising the Libyan people. I'm praising the form of democracy that they live. I'm praising their tolerance for all religions, where none were prejudiced or biased. I'm praising the fact that you could walk down the streets at any time, day or night, safely. I'm praising they had no debt. I'm praising that they had 24 tons of gold and wanted to go to the gold denier. Where's the wisdom to all the other nations in Africa that had Gaddafi succeeded, it would have been a whole new renaissance for Africa and the largest man-made water project in the world in Libya? And look at our infrastructure. Where's the wisdom that we will not put a penny into new bridges and dams and reforesting at least 100 million trees per state to capture the carbon and moving towards a plant-based diet to save up? If the whole world went vegan, we would reduce carbon by over 27% carbon emissions, and we would help with our diseases. Where's the wisdom? A medical industrial complex does not care as much about healing you as it does about making sure that they're paid all profit all the time. And a media that refuses to acknowledge the sexual predations for decades of Bill Clinton and others, but immediately pounces on anyone else. Where's the objectivity? Where's the fairness? Where's the equality of justice? Where's the wisdom? So that's our program. Let's now go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by, and he is going to take us on this journey. And he is a person who's been on this program before. And I welcome Jim Garrison. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
Good to be with you again, Gary.
I've given you a lot to take off on.
indeed you have. And I appreciate the scope and depth of your sort of awareness of the global crisis in which we find ourselves. And it reminded me that even though the academic institutions are largely silent, one good thing about what's going on is that the scientific community is very, very active. I'm sure you saw many of your listeners that the last week, in fact, over 15,000 scientists in 180 countries issued a new warning. It was called the World Scientist Warning to Humanity. And it followed up on the 1992 scientific warning to humanity that the Earth was on track to be irretrievably mutilated, is the way they put it back in 1992. And the scientific statement last week chronicled many of the things that you talked about and said that the situation is in fact getting worse. That since 1992, for example, something like 26% increased loss in fresh water per person around the world, 75% increase in the number of dead zones around, mostly in the oceans near the coastal areas and many of the Superfund sites in different countries around the world, 62% increase in CO2 emissions since 1992, and of course a 35% increase in human population. So we need to take in that we as a species are in the process of doing irredeemable mutilation. I think that's a very appropriate word for what we're doing to our own planet. Because in no category of human concern, whether it's population or conservation of forests or grasslands, whether it's government interventions to stop biodiversity loss, poaching, illicit trade of animals, even people, the governments worldwide are either turning a blind eye and a deaf ear, or worse, like they are here in the United States, actively perpetuating the crisis that is undermining the possibility of the larger ecosystem supporting our species. I think the point that I would like to begin with is to underscore the depth of the crisis in the following way, which I think gets to an awareness of what you're calling to our attention in terms of why on earth can't we stop? And it's worth pointing out that since the advent of our species, as a species Homo sapiens 150,000 years ago, our species from the very first moment has been extraordinarily destructive to virtually every environment in which we've traveled. So for example, when 40,000 years ago, the aboriginals, as they're called now, came in from Southeast Asia into Australia, they wiped out 23 of 24 mammal species over the weight of 100 pounds. When the first human beings came across the Bering Strait about 12,000, 13,000 years ago, down into Canada, North America, Mesoamerica, and then Latin America, they wiped out over 50% of all the mammals over 100 pounds. The second large decimation of other species and the environment started with the agricultural revolution. And what we're experiencing today, it's just worth noting, is that under the Industrial Revolution, we're engaging in the third major species extinction caused by our species, Homo sapiens. People often point to the fact this is the sixth major planetary species extinction, and that's absolutely true. But we need to take in, as a human race, that our species from the very beginning has acted completely unconsciously, and it hasn't mattered whether they're, again, Aboriginals in Australia, whether they've been the Aztecs or the Incas, whether they've been the Zulus in Southern Africa, as the, you know, the Caucasians and the modern Europeans, etc., we're much more familiar with that. But there's something in our species that does not abide by any boundaries, that exploits virtually every environment in which it has found itself, and then moves on. And what we need to come to terms with in our generation is that because of the massive populations that are now burgeoning in every corner of the planet, and because of the industrial capacity for exploitation, not only of planet, but people and atmosphere, we're coming to the point where we may take our species out of the game. And so I thought it would be good to start with just, this is more than ideology. You know, we often think, as Naomi Klein has in one of her recent books, sort of to blame it on capitalism. And certainly capitalism is to blame. Blamed it on neoliberalism. And that's certainly part of the problem. Based it on imperialism. That's certainly part of the problem. But I believe if we really look at ourselves over the history of when our kind first emerged through the cognitive revolution about 150,000 years ago, where somehow our brain capacity expanded and allowed us a versatility and an adaptivity and a resilience as a species. You know, we're the only species that's been able to go into every single niche around the world and conquer it. Whether we went to the northern Arctic, whether we went to the deserts of the Kalahari, whether we went to the jungles of the Amazonia, the high steppes of the Mongolian plateau, our species has been so powerful and so relentless in its exploitation that what we're doing now is what we've always done, with almost no exceptions. So when we think about how we remedy it, the problem is so deeply systemic into the very DNA and psychic structure of what it means to be human. We have to ponder more thoroughly any potential answers that may arise. And I'm happy to explore some of those, but I'll pause now to see if there's any comment or additional questions you might want to make.
There is. Jim, as you know, and from having been on this program many times, I'm always interested in the people who really hold the power behind the scenes. Could you begin to carry on what you were just saying, but talk about the last president of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, when he met Henry Kissinger at the Council on Foreign Relations, the preeminent think tank for the American Empire. And I feel it would be good to educate our audience on who Gorbachev was, because he was replying to Kissinger's question, very important, very poignant guidance to the dystopian state of the world that we have entered. And sometimes we never look back. We only look at the crisis we're in, and we can't look forward. I think it's very important that we see how we got to this mess we're in today, where we're living in complete denialism of cause and effect. We have abrogated all responsibility at the moral level, at the ethical and spiritual level, to pure political science and the politics of science and the politics of medicine, rather than what is best for the planet, what is best for people, what is best for different cultures. So could you take that from there, please?
Well, it's interesting. I happen to have been there. As part of my history, I spent about 10 years working very closely with Mikhail Gorbachev. I met him in 1991, and then in 1992, I organized his first trip to the United States in May of 1992 to meet with former President Ronald Reagan. We traveled around the United States for several weeks. And one of our stops was in New York at the Council on Foreign Relations, in which he was going to give an address. And after his speech, Mr. Kissinger asked him a very simple question: "Mr. Gorbachev, why did you fall?" And Gorbachev was slightly taken aback. Then he made a joke first, saying, "Well, that's what I'm writing my autobiography to find out." But then he paused and he said, "In the end, I fell because I did not analyze reality ruthlessly enough." And that remark, you know, was very poignant, and it indicated the reason why all of us make mistakes, you know, ultimately, is because we're not analyzing reality ruthlessly enough. Now, the other side of that was a meeting that, again, I was very privileged to participate in sometime later with Edward Shevardnadze, who served under Mr. Gorbachev as his foreign minister for the 6 years that he was president of the Soviet Union before it broke up between 1985 and 1991. Mr. Shevardnadze ended up going back to the Republic of Georgia and becoming the first president of the new Independent Republic of Georgia. I coordinated the first American business delegation to go there. And while we were meeting in his office, one of the Americans asked Shevardnadze, "How did you guys do all this? I mean, you unraveled the nuclear thing, the Berlin Wall came down, you engaged in perestroika and glasnost in the Soviet Union, and was transformed into the Russian Republic and so forth." And Shevardnadze again made a statement that I'll never forget. He said, "Well, you know, many people attribute to us great genius for what we did and what happened. But," he says, "we were simply ordinary mortals who had the good sense to let history work her will through us." And I think, Gary, that to me is a subtle, very nuanced, but powerful illumination that, you know, Gorbachev was able to do what he did with Shevardnadze, Alexander Yakovlev, and others, because even though he was operating within the strictures of the most totalitarian system of the 20th century, that by his time had stood for nearly 70 years, he let history work her will through him, and it changed the world. So when we talk about social change in the face of deep crisis, oftentimes we look for things that are very powerful. We want an observable, almost coercive answer to our problems. But when it comes, it often comes through someone like Gorbachev, you know, who was nobody. He came from a farm in the Urals. He worked his way up. He had no particular charism or qualifications. He was spotted actually by Alexander Yakovlev, who at the time was the head of ideology in the Politburo. And I spent a lot of time with Yakovlev, and I asked him, so how did you, what attracted you about Gorbachev? And he said, well, you know, the leadership of the Soviet Union was so brain dead. I could tell that Gorbachev had a certain softness to him, was the way he put it, and a certain elegance of spirit. And I just had this feeling that if I brought him into the Politburo, he would have a salutary effect on the leadership. And he ended up becoming the general secretary in March of 1985. One of the extraordinary observations that Yakovlev made about Gorbachev, by the way, because I tracked Yakovlev, and then I knew him after Gorbachev resigned in December of 1991 and worked with him till he died, actually, a number of years later. And I asked him once, so how would you summarize the genius of Gorbachev? And he said, well, you know, in the 6 years that he was the general secretary, not once did he use violence as a recourse to solve a problem. And if you think about this, you're talking about a system that was predicated on violence against millions of people and set up an extraordinarily coercive and pervasive police state. And yet Gorbachev, as the head of that system, not once in 6 years, according to Yakovlev, did he ever use violence as a recourse. And I remember when I was traveling with Gorbachev, I asked him, you know, what he'd learned. And he said to me once, he said, Jim, one thing I've learned, and that is there is no problem confronting society that cannot be solved through implementing a political process in which everybody concerned participates in some way. So he even, you think about, for example, the collapse of the Berlin Wall. I mean, in 1968, 1956, in Hungary and then Czechoslovakia, every time the Eastern Europeans had tried to exert their independence, the Soviet Union came down with coercive force and tanks and brutality. When it happened under Gorbachev, what did Gorbachev do? He understood the will of history. He understood that Eastern Europe needed to be free. And I count the liberation of Europe, Eastern Europe, from the Soviet Union without firing a shot as probably the most sophisticated and elegant act of statesmanship maybe in the 20th century. You look at what's happening in Spain right now with the vote of Catalonia. Everybody knows that for centuries the Catalonians have felt themselves independent of Spain. And yet the Spanish will use any measure of coercive force to keep the Catalonians in a union in which they do not believe. And I've often thought of our problems today and the willingness of states and corporations to use coercive violence that blocks the flow of history, and what it would mean if all of us would look at our problems, bring the necessary stakeholders together, and engage in a political process in which everyone was honored. You'd have a burst of energy into our collective system that would honor the statesmanship of a of a man like Gorbachev. And I believe initiate the solution to many of our problems. I mean, just to take a quick example, then I'll close. I mean, look at the Paris Accord. I mean, they just, around climate change, negotiated by every nation in the world.
Except the United States.
Except the United States.
We did not sign off on it.
We didn't sign off on it, and now even Syria, which was another holdout, has signed, and the United States and the Trump administration is giving the Paris Accords the boot. If the United States would enter into these political processes in the spirit of what Gorbachev understood and engage in fair-minded, open-hearted dialogue to actually solve the problem, these problems that seem so intractable and in fact are threatening our viability as a species would melt away in very short order. So the solution is, as Einstein has said so poignantly, is that the consciousness that produced the problem can't solve it. So there are examples of solutions that are right in front of us and have happened in our own lifetime. One thinks, for example, of South Africa, when de Klerk and Nelson Mandela sat down as human beings and prevented probably what would have been a major, unprecedented bloodbath in South Africa by allowing a political process to unfold that had many problems, many challenges, but included the Truth and Reconciliation Commission headed by Desmond Tutu. So you can find examples around the world in our time of where our species has been able to rise to the level of allowing history to work her will through us. So that should be some kind of inspiration to us, even in the, under the present seemingly very dire predicament in which we find ourselves.
Jim, thank you. That was a very good historical analysis of how the world changed under Gorbachev. And most people would not know that not once did he use violence. Though I believe there was once where, I think it was under Gorbachev and not Yeltsin, that troops were sent into Georgia when Georgia was seeking its independence. Was that under Gorbachev or under Yeltsin?
No, that was under Yeltsin. The one time that Gorbachev, I think, acquiesced to violence because the forces in the Politburo were so strong was in Lithuania. Remember that the Baltic states were becoming increasingly restless. Gorbachev had just sort of let Eastern Europe go. The Baltics tried to follow suit. The Russians were not prepared. They were ready to let Eastern Europe go under duress just because Gorbachev was the head of the system, but not Lithuania. So there was that one incident where I think several dozen people were killed, but it was clear even at that time that Gorbachev resisted the use of violence as long as he could.
Now, compare Gorbachev, and remember that
it was Gorbachev that withdrew the Soviet troops from Afghanistan. That was one of his first
acts. That's
correct.
After what? They were there about 13 years?
Yeah.
And they lost a lot of troops, I believe over 15,000 troops. Now, compare that to Barack Obama, also a winner of the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, but he engaged in seven wars, invading seven countries and putting forward the proposition of a new $1.5 trillion nuclear arms budget, increase the military-industrial complex. FISA courts were overruled and virtually rubber-stamped every opportunity to spy on Americans. He broke every single rule when it came to honoring the people that he had pledged that he would help them out of poverty and save their jobs. He did nothing of the kind, just the opposite. But that's not where I want to go now. I was thinking of something. One of your first books in the early 1980s was The Darkness of God, Theology After Hiroshima.
Yep.
And when I reflect upon that title and consider the threats of climate change today, we are today faced two inconvenient truths. Actually, the first truth, well before Al Gore's movie, was the dropping of the uranium and plutonium bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, followed by the Cold War race to build nuclear arsenals. And because it was at that time, for the first time in history, that humanity became aware that it held in its power the capacity to self-annihilate itself in a nuclear storm. Then, starting around the early 1980s, the Nobel Prize chemist Paul Crutzen coined and defined the term Anthropocene Age as a new planetary geographical age wherein humans are now driving atmospheric and geological events and will continue to do so for thousands of years, even after we've gone extinct. And we're lucky if we don't go extinct within the next 100 years. And by the way, just as an aside, for a new film that I'm working on and a new major new book on the environment, I've interviewed at least 16, a lot more than 16, but of all the people I've interviewed, 16 climatologists have all told me that the whole body of scientific literature is being misrepresented by an ultra-conservative view of the environmental events, meaning we're told, don't worry, it won't happen in your lifetime that the water will rise or that we'll have massive hurricanes or that there'll be these cataclysmic events or, you know, the Arctic won't melt in your lifetime. So then people say, okay, well, I have nothing to worry about. Why should I care about, you know, where I throw this plastic bottle or where it ends up? Or I don't care if I eat genetically engineered material versus organic. So this, in effect, and I ask them, why are they doing this? In fact, one of the people I interviewed was the real-life character that the Jeff Goldblum character in Jurassic Park, the chaos theorist, was based upon. And I said, from all that I have studied, and I've read thousands of articles, and all that I've done to try to find the truth, I believe that we are going to start feeling the direct impact, the outer waves of the environmental superstorms now. Right now,
yes.
As we live,
yes.
And it'll only accelerate, but it's going to accelerate in chaos theory so that instead of saying that there's a mathematical model that'll tell you how bad the storms will be next year, there won't be. That how long it's going to take Greenland to melt, there won't. That now we're finding volcanoes, 12 active volcanoes under Antarctica, and it's melting it faster. And so no mathematical model that predicts we're not going to have a problem is accurate. And say, he said, you're right. He said, there is no predictable model in existence that can tell us how long we have until we start having it. And one of the people was very specific. And he said, Gary, we're going to start seeing parts of the world, whole parts of the world, starting in the Middle East and at least Northern Africa, where they won't be able to plant very much, and they'll have very low yields because the soil will be too hot. The seeds won't germinate. That'll mean that they'll have to start doing hydroponic gardening, which they are doing in some areas, like in Gibraltar, but they don't have the means and won't do it in most of Africa. So you're going to see the largest environmental migrants in world history. Well, last year we estimated there were over 90 million people, but they weren't the people who see went to Europe. Those people had money. They had lived in Libya. They had savings. They lived in Syria. They had educations. And still, they had a rough trip getting out of their countries into a safer environment. And those environments they're in, with the exception of Sweden and Norway and a few that have given them really nice standard of living and cash stipends every month, a lot of them, they're still living in refugee camps. In fact, I'm working on a project. I'm the nutritionist for the project of the Syrian refugees in Greece on the islands. I was asked by a group of Australian medical doctors who head the foundation that feeds these people what I could do, and I'm trying to supply about this year about 75,000 complete nutrition programs, meaning everything they need in their nutrition every day they'll get for free, and I'll be going back, going to Greece in the spring to implement this and build some greenhouses. But be that as it may, he said, then it's going to be in Europe. Right now in the Middle East, you have complete drought in Yemen, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Syria, in Lebanon, most of Lebanon. He said, they're not going to be able to grow diddly squat. You already have. You can't grow anything really unless it's artificial man-made in three other countries. He said, but it's going to get so hot that unless you're inside 24/7, and he said, and then watch the superstorms in the United States. Well, mind you, I had that interview with him about 9 months ago. Look at the superstorm. Superstorm hit Florida, Louisiana. Superstorm hit Texas. Then look at the fires. Worst fires in California history. Look at the fire in Montana, the worst in the state's history. In Washington State and Oregon, the worst in their history. In British Columbia. So all these honest environmental experts, no one wants to hear their story because it scares people. And no one's willing to say, you got to move. How in the hell are you going to get 38 million people moving out of California because it's not sustainable in the future? It's going to be a dust bowl. How are you going to do it? You can't because you don't have the political will and people don't want to move. In fact, California had, I believe it was 150,000 plus people move out last year than moved in. So some people are moving. But we're not voluntarily doing it. And as a government, we're not doing it. So we're not doing the things we should do. Your thoughts on the idea that, because I know this is close to you, that we don't get ahead of a problem. We follow it. And we generally follow it first with blame. And as you know, this year we've had record-breaking heat waves, floods, extreme storms, droughts, milestone climate change events, like as the first Arctic Northwest route crossing without the need of icebreakers, and the Delaware-sized break of the Larsen Sea ice shelf in West Antarctica. And under Trump, we now have both of these dark specters facing us. So if I were to look at this crisis ruthlessly, what you said Gorbachev said he should have done, what would the realization and the conclusion we should draw be?
Well, that's a very deep question. A couple of things just emerge in my mind. The gravity of the crisis, I think, referring back to the book I wrote called The Darkness of God, Theology After Hiroshima, one of the points that I made in that book was that in our generation, in our day, after 4.5 billion years of evolutionary life on planet Earth, our species has brought the entire life process to the brink of extinction. And that is the single most important question confronting the human race. And you've detailed all or many of the aspects of that. But our species has done something in our generation, starting with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, with climate change, with the global challenges that are threatening now life as we know it. And we have to take that in. Second point that I think is worth contemplating, because this is when it got really scary to me. We're the first generation where we're experiencing a confluence between religious prophecies about the end of time and scientific, secular descriptions and predictions about the end of time. So, for example, if you go back, 1,000 years, when there were some people in Europe thinking that, Christ was coming again and they sold everything and went out to the local hilltop, they may have believed it religiously, but there was nothing in the secular environment that would have indicated that there was any problem. The only problem was happening inside their heads. But one of the extraordinary phenomena is that every major religious tradition, whether it's Buddhism or Islam or Hinduism, think of many people are familiar with the Hindu notion of the Kali Yuga, that we're at the end of the Kali Yuga age, a time of great darkness. One of Muhammad's last prophecies was that there would be a time of darkness. And the Hopi prophecies, there's the Mayan prophecies, there's all kinds of prophecies. What's common to all of them is they seem to have pointed to our time, and all the descriptions of the end are catastrophic ecological events. Well, if you just go to where I started, you know, when you have 15,000 scientists that don't have any religious persuasion, that at least was manifested in their document, from 180 countries, serving the human race with its second notice, the first one being in 1992, saying that we are mutilating our world and we're about ready to undermine the framework for the viability of our species. You have a confluence of religious and spiritual prophecy and secular scientific reality. And I think that framework is what you're pointing to. And so that means that the only solution is a reinvention of the human. How do we, through education, through your program, how do we reinvent who we believe we are at a time where, if we don't, none of us and our children may survive beyond 2100. And, you know, it gets even more ironic in a way if you think of, like, Paul Hawken just came out with a book called Drawdown, where he offers 100 solutions to reverse global warming, all of which are practical, doable, and in many cases are being worked on, but without government support. And therefore, they're not allowed to come to scale. You know, you think back since the Second World War. You know, before the Second World War, there wasn't really any civil society to speak of. But since the Second World War, 70 years ago, look at the explosion of NGOs around the world. Look at the explosion of women's liberation. Look at the explosion of the gender and sexual revolution. Look at the ways in which spirituality has separated itself from religion. I mean, we've been undergoing, as the crisis deepens, we're at the same level undergoing a plethora of solutions from the scientific sector, the technical sector. So even while science and technology are destroying us, science and technology are giving us the solutions. Even as we're exploiting and dominating, women around the world are becoming liberated. And even if you think of the phenomena around the United States, in particular over the last couple of months with Roy Moore and Senator Franken and the various people that have been brought down by sexual harassment, Harvey Weinstein, etc., that's progress. Because what was assumed as what men did to women 30, 40 years ago, even 10 or 15 years ago, is now no longer okay. That is progress. So it's extraordinary that while the crisis deepens, our solutions are flourishing. And as Lester Brown has said many times, the human race finds itself in a race of tipping points. We have negative tipping points, we have positive tipping points. And as I'm not sure who said it, I can't remember now, but it was things are getting better and better and worse, faster and faster. Time is speeding up. And in this contradiction, in this cognitive dissonance, with everybody from, you know, Donald Trump to Gary Null, the problem and the solution, we're in a crescendo of possibility. And within this context, our generation in our time has to redefine who it is, not only in relationship to each other, but in relationship to the larger ecosystem. And the final comment that I would make is, I believe, Gary, you know, this black swan phenomenon is, I think, a source of great hope. 9/11 came out of nowhere. No one predicted it. And yet once it happened, everybody said, well, of course something like this was going to happen. Gorbachev was a black swan event. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Soviet Union were black swan events. Nelson Mandela and de Klerk were black swan events. And what that means, if you look at chaos theory, if you look at how history moves, oftentimes the surface appears static and calm, like the Soviet Union. Nobody, there wasn't a single Sovietologist in the world that predicted the demise of the Soviet Union, and it happened in a couple of weeks. Nobody predicted
that. That said, we're coming up to the end of the program, but I want to share a few thoughts and have a short answer from you.
Yeah.
Because pulling off what you just said, one odd paradox we're witnessing, not just in the United States, but also in many European countries, including France and Austria, even in Japan and the Philippines, are democratic structures and values giving way to neoconservative and even fascistic principles.
That's true.
And in their last election cycle this year, even the Nazi Party won seats in Germany's parliament. We would think that democracy and the values of liberty were everything contrary to fascism and totalitarian worldviews, yet here we find them emerging within democratic structures themselves. And so we have to ask, how does this happen from a metaphysical or transpersonal point of view and the historical impasse the globalized world has entered? And looking at this from a transpersonal perspective, I believe that there is a correlation, or at least a relationship, between this rise in authoritarian worldviews with rising global warming and climate change events and social and economic consequences, which are already being felt and will only worsen. And all of our institutions, all of them, Jim, are either being seriously questioned or are in the midst of collapse, and capitalism has failed to reach its goals and promises, except for the select few, and democracy is biting its own tail and giving rise to horrendous extremism, and more people suffer stress and mental disturbances. Our entire modern society is hyperactive, and everything we believe would bring peace and order to life is now fragile or broken, and more people are becoming depressed and feeling incapacitated to do anything but hope and pray, and that is not going to work because our senses are numb. And this goes to the heart of looking at the relationship between order and disorder, not simply from the viewpoint of scientific physics, but from the psychological and social and even spiritual perspective. Yet at the same time, the chaos appears to be birthing new spiritual realizations and new ethics, and growing numbers of people are looking at alternative ways of living that are more healthy and natural. So, short answer, Jim, in this darkness, in this chaos that is now depressing more and more people, where and how do we find light? And how can the chaos of breakdown and regression serve as a means for acquiring a new and healthier perspective about life and our communion with others and the planet at large?
Very quickly, I would refer to, again, Paul Hawken, as I just was. You know, he has a statement that if you don't have alarm in every cell in your body, you're not paying attention. And if you don't see that the solutions are emerging all around you, you're not truly alive. We have a crisis, and all around us, people are becoming more and more active. And I think the solution is for every single one of us, as you are doing in your life and on your shows and through your documentaries and writings, and I am through Ubiquity University. As my friend Andrew Harvey says, what wakes you up at 3 o'clock in the morning and fills your heart with passion? That's what you should be doing. And it is time to take a stand, as the Native Americans did at Standing Rock, as people are doing around the world. And I think, back to Shevardnadze, the forces of history are working. If all of us do what we can do, at some point through the darkness, the sun is going to emerge, and we will realize as we look back that, yes, there was a lot more light hidden by the darkness than we thought. And now it's going to emerge, but it's going to take all of us every day taking the stand that our heart compels us to take. That's the solution that I live by. I'm responsible for my life, and I make the stand as you do. And I so salute you, Gary, and acknowledge your leadership. It's a model for all of us.
Thank you very much, Jim. As always, we appreciate you being on and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you.
My guest, Dr. Jim Garrison, a continuation of our conversation with Remarkable Minds. And Jim is the author of America as Empire, Global Leader, or Rogue Power, as well as Civilization and the Transformation of Power. And Jim, by the way, has graduate degrees in religion, theology from Harvard University and other places. All the best. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many.